believe assault is an act, not an adjective. Your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes. Your safety is your responsibility, not the government's, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener. Because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live, right now. Call 1-800-313-9443.
Good morning, everyone. Pleasure to be here for you this morning, and I'd like to thank RJ and welcome his audience. Another great show, RJ. Little bit of information out of Boston. The FBI that looks into the ideas what they do is they qualify different cities and different regions as possible terror targets. So the FBI is apparently concerned that Boston, Massachusetts could be a little bit higher on the list. Part of the reason that they cite that is that Boston PD is not issued any form of rifle. They have handguns and they have shotguns. Well, both, you know, a shotgun's a great friend in a gunfight as long as it's not too far out. Once you get beyond, you know, 35 yards or so, 40, 50 yards, depending on the shotgun, the load, all that good stuff. You know, if you're using that federal tactical, I forget the actual name of it, that actually holds a much tighter pattern, or you're shooting a Vancomp barrel, something like that, it's good just so far. So a rifle is where it's at. And most departments will go with an AR-15. Well, as it turns out, the Boston Police Department was able to get some rifles. They were actually looking at M16s, which we'll address in a moment. A plan was in the works to arm Boston police with their M16s, but the mayor, a very big anti-gun guy by the name of Thomas Menino, put the brakes on that idea and said, no, we're not going to have assault rifles in the hands of our police. So the FBI believes that Boston might be a little higher up on the food chain for potential terrorist attack. Now, why doesn't the mayor want the Boston police to be armed with rifles? Image. Really, image. He's an anti-gun guy, so why would he arm the police with the same sort of anti-gun thing? Now, this is somebody who truly is anti-gun, not just somebody who's in the government that wants the people to be disarmed. You see, there's two big distinctions there. Generally, people in the government that come across as anti-gun are actually just pro-control. So this gun control thing, there's two different areas of it. People such as this mayor in Boston, the mayor in Seattle, the Violence Policy Center, the Brady Campaign, they are anti-gun. The people in Washington, D.C., up on the Hill, and in the White House, throughout Washington, the people in Sacramento, California, they are not anti-gun, they're anti-control. I'm sorry, they're pro-control, pardon me. They don't want guns in the hands of the people because they want to be able to much more easily control them. So gun control has two completely different families, two completely different groups that look at gun control to achieve two different things for different reasons. Well, actually, it's the same thing, but for different reasons. So we're going to address this M16 in the hands of police issue after the break. So stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
Rule 1, assume it's loaded. Rule 2, Don't point it at anything you're not willing to destroy. Rule 3. Listen to the 2A Radio Show with Bill Karnes. 1-800-313-9443.
Okay, so the question comes out. When it comes to issuing rifles to police, of course, they've got to go through training and such. There was a case here in Las Vegas where, as a matter of fact, I left in the Las Vegas Metro in May of 96. About a month or two or three later, they started with a program where officers could carry AR-15s or Mini-14s in their car. They had to carry a specific type of ammo. They had to provide their own gun. Go through the week-long training, or however long it was. I think it was 4 days, which is a week for the cops because they work 4-10s generally. I think the detectives work a standard 5-8, but street cops work 4-10s. So anyway, for the street cops, they had to provide their own gun. Had to go through weapons inspection. They had to carry, I think it was 55 grain rounds, and they couldn't have anything more than a 20-round magazine on it, and they could carry it in the car, be their own personal gun. In addition, you could actually carry your own personal shotgun as opposed to a department-issued shotgun if you went through the inspection. So the question then came out about, well, should we eventually arm everybody with these things? So I don't really recall what happened with Metro specifically, but I do know that it came out that you could eventually end up carrying a rifle. Now, one thing that happened was there was a felony suspect that was stopped on the road, got out, started shooting at police. Now, they'd been trailing this guy. There were some detectives involved. There was some Metro cops involved, some regular patrol officers. And one of the detectives pulled his AR-15 out of his trunk and from the hip started shooting at the suspect. Went through an entire magazine, didn't hit him once. Then inserted a second magazine, got about halfway through that, never hitting the suspect, before a patrol officer physically restrained him from shooting from the hip, like it was some sort of frickin' Hollywood movie or something. And what happened with that detective? Now, I think the guy should have got hours, had the gun taken away, you know, maybe been demoted, all kinds of stuff. Now, he got a letter of commendation. So that tells you how ignorant the people are upstairs when it comes to the management of the police department. Let's see, we have a caller, Jeremy from Indiana. You're on 2A Radio. Welcome.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Well, I was wondering, I was calling to let you know what was going on in Northwest Indiana and maybe what's going on where you're at with the ammo prices. I'm a patriot and I believe in the Constitution and the Second Amendment, and I used to go probably shoot about 1,000 rounds a weekend target practice.
Oh, good for you.
I was working gun shows, and 7.62-39s and other ones, other shells were selling about $70 a case. They've run most of the local gun stores out of the Northwest Indiana, closed them up. The police have done stings on them saying they're rogue purchases for Chicago, and they came in and closed one of our largest ones down.
Wow.
I went in just to price ammunition, and it's almost $400 a case. And I said, what? And I just got rid of a lot of ammunition to buy new ammunition and not knowing the prices on this.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked why this is, and they said ever since the Obama administration, prices has went up 3 times.
Oh, you know what? It actually started before Obama got into office, when it looked like he might get into office. So now we're dating ourselves maybe a year and a half now. Ammo prices started skyrocketing, absolutely skyrocketing. Many of the manufacturers are working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They put on extra shifts just so that they can try to meet with the demands. This is certainly not any brand new news, but to hear that they're doing stings in Indiana to prevent something going on in Illinois, it sounds like the idea of them trying to take away rifles from us here in America to try to solve some Mexican drug cartel problem south of the border.
That's right. There were officers coming in, posing, you know, and doing straw purchases, they called it, and they closed down its Blythe. They tried to get Blythe and Fetless Trading Post, which has been around forever, which was one of the largest distributors. They would get cases and cases of firearms and surplus firearms. You know, that's when you could get an SKS for $100, $75.
Here's my question for you, Jeremy. Did anybody think to do a citizen's arrest on the cop that was doing the straw purchase? Because that's illegal. That's a federal offense. So I'm wondering if anybody ever thought to do an arrest on them. Oh, no, they're protected under the law. Well, you're going to have to show that to me, because as of right now, this guy performed a straw purchase and just admitted it. That's the way I look at this thing.
The police up here, I live right on the boundary of the country, the county, and we were shooting. I had my Class 3 license, and we were shooting subguns, and they came out, and they searched our property, and I had a lot of flares and smoke canisters. And they actually brought the ATF in, and this was right after 9/11. And they confiscated everything and asked me what military base did I steal it from. And I bought them legally. You know, this is when you could still buy pop smoke grenades. And
right.
We would use them for paintball exercises or just, you know, target practice exercises. And the police actually came in and took all of that, and they took over 3,000 rounds of ammunition.
Did you ever get any of
that?
Did you ever get any
of
stuff?
Back.
No? Did it ever go in front of a judge or anything?
No, it did not. They just took it, sat me at the police station for about 6 hours, and then said, you're free to go. And I said, well, what about my stuff? You know, and they said, well, if you want to continue this, then we could talk to the prosecutor. You know, if you have 10 cases of ammunition in your house because you're worried about prices going up, they call that a cache, you know, or a... But if you're in the gun business, that's called inventory, you know, and I was in the gun show business.
You know,
so it seems like...
I got to tell you, Jeremy, I tell you what I would do is I would go to the state police and I would file charges of theft, of grand larceny on whatever department it was that came in and took your stuff. That's what I would do. I appreciate the call. I would love to carry on with this, but I got a pretty full show. Is that cool with you, man?
I sure do.
All right,
thank you very much, Jeremy.
Have a good one.
Keep doing a great job. Great American.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. So back on to the rifles here. The question comes out, we were talking about the cop that was hip shooting. Imagine if that was full auto. Some departments actually issue M16s to their officers as opposed to AR-15s. Now, of course, their cost is negligible. It really doesn't matter. They're buying the post band, so it's the same price. You know, an AR-15 to a police department might be $800 or $900. An M16 would still be about $800 or $900. They're going to go through more ammo. Now, I've got to tell you, of all the different courses I've ever written curriculum for and run, M16 has its own special place. To fire one of these rifles on full auto, first of all, it's got the cartridge itself is not that powerful, but it does give a little bit of recoil. Not one round, two rounds, three rounds fired individually on semi-autos, no big deal. But when they get into full auto, and the cyclic rate on these guns is around 1,000 rounds per minute. All right? So 1,000 rounds a minute, correct me if I'm wrong, that's about 6 rounds a second. No? I'm sorry. It's harder than that. It's more like 12. Whatever it turns out to be. It's a very high rate of fire. Very high rate. And that gun will push you back. The grip and stance that you must use to fire one of these guns on full auto and keep it under control is pretty extreme. And not everybody can do it. Additionally, on full auto, you're firing at one guy. You get a burst out there. Now, some of the M16s issued to the military have what's called a 3-round burst on it, that you can't get more than 3 rounds. Well, I'm here to tell you, the proper number to actually modulate through is 2, not 3. Because I don't care how good you are, it is really difficult to get a 3-round burst into the chest cavity area of bad guy A standing down range of you, even as far out as 15 yards. Really, full auto ends when it comes to an M16 at about 15 yards. Otherwise, you have a Rule 4 issue with a round screaming down range with a "to whom it may concern" inscribed on it. All right? So, in the military itself, even though the military has M16s, everybody shoots on semi-auto, unless you get higher up into the echelon, maybe into the Rangers. I'm not even sure if the Rangers go anything full auto. Some of the teams will go full auto, some of the small specialty teams, but most of the time, it's on semi-auto. You just don't zip people up. So to actually give an M16 to a street cop is a bad idea. AR-15's really where it's at. If I had the opportunity to have an M16, which I do not, it would not be something that I would really desire. I would most likely fire down semi-auto like I would an AR-15, because then every round counts. I'm not the type of guy if, you know, cover fire, you know, like on TV. You see 24 and Jack Bauer has his pistol and two extra magazines, and he uses two of the magazines for cover fire before he actually starts aiming and shooting. Okay, that's not the way it goes down. One round, one hit. One round, one hit. If I have 85 rounds between a bunch of magazines, between three magazines and my AR, 85 rounds are expected to hit their intended target. All right, I'm not going to have 85 rounds and expect to take on four guys. 85 rounds hit 85 specifically aimed and pressed shots on target. So to have an M16 in the hands of just the average Joe beat cop or detective or something is really something that the administration in these departments doesn't know what they're doing. And certainly I would doubt that there's hardly any police training out there anywhere that would prepare them how to do it or recognize when to be on semi or when to be on full. It takes a lot more training than just a week. A lot more. So I'm not a fan of M16s in the hands of police because the lack of training. Military, sure. If you're going to take the police and you're going to let them train on that thing for a couple of days every month if they're going to carry it, just in case they need to use it, then fine. Otherwise, keep it in AR-15. One round, one hit. One round, one hit. That's all you need. It's already horrendously poor hit ratio with police. Don't give them full autos on top of it. Stay tuned, guys. There's more to come. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
The alcohol have tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. Right now, live, the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
All right, folks, so I had told you that yesterday that I finally got all those rockin' awesome Thanksgiving recipes up on 2aradio.com. So check it out, 2aradio.com. Click on the big banner up towards the top that says something about awesome Thanksgiving recipes. Each one of those has a little link. You can have their own page. You can print those out. I've already been told by one person in particular that they're starting to make the rounds on Facebook and even some emails here and there. So feel free. Look at that stuff. Pass it around. Take a look at it and try them. Oh, my God. I am so looking forward to this. Now, I will actually probably go doing all my shopping on Saturday is my best guess, probably with everybody else. Heck, maybe I'll go tomorrow just a little bit early and try to get all of my stuff lined up for Thanksgiving. And when I start cooking, of course, it starts Wednesday with brining the bird and prepping everybody when it comes to what they need to bring so that they can start getting their stuff together. You know, like my daughter's coming out. She's going to be bringing her her yams, the same recipe that you find on there. Of course, getting the stuffing prepared. So enjoy, all right? Really, please. And I realize oftentimes there's a lot of tradition in the different families. You know, like Aunt May does the turkey and Uncle Joe does the stuffing. And I got to tell you, if you actually go ahead and do the stuffing the way it's prescribed, it's going to be unreal. You're not going to have to worry about, you know, any of this garbage with just using stovetop. If you're not interested, in there it says actually take the bread, toast the bread, butter the bread, then cut the bread up, and then salt it and everything. If you want to get away from actually making the breadcrumbs yourself, go get toasted, seasoned breadcrumbs and use that in lieu of, you know, baking the better part of a loaf of bread. You know, I'm sorry, not baking it, but toasting it and buttering it. Just go buy the breadcrumbs. It'll make it easier. It's still an excellent, excellent stuffing. And by the way, you don't stuff the stuffing into the bird. It's a completely different dish. So cook the bird without the stuffing. Cook the stuffing separate from the bird. If you want to dump it in there later so people can have the pleasure of digging stuffing out of the center of the bird hole, great. But don't cook the two of them together. It's not going to be a good combination. Do everything separately. Look at those recipes, guys. You're going to love them. There is a little bit more effort in there. I know a lot of people are very, very proud of their own recipes, even if they suck and you end up with a really lousy, you know, 19-cent a pound bird, and it comes out dry, and you know, you need to suck down a gallon of water with every half plate load because you have to rehydrate this turkey jerky. Whoever cooks that bird, let them know, look, we want to do a little bit of a change up here. I'll take care of the bird if you want to handle this or something. Find a smooth way of going about it and then blow their socks off. I was dating a girl a couple years back, 2-3 years ago, and about 3 years back. And her mother, very, very good woman, good woman, and not really in very good physical shape. And so we went over to Christmas, and my girlfriend and I over at her house, which had it was a very difficult kitchen to work in. It was very small. Not everything was working. The water heater had gone out, so we didn't have hot water. We had to heat any water we wanted hot. The space, the amount of room in the oven, everything was very, very, very difficult to deal with. I wanted to prep a bunch of stuff at my house because I got this big, beautiful kitchen and then take it over. The answer was no. All right, no, we had to do it over there. So we did this. And, of course, her mom had always handled the turkey. And, I was told that a lot of people weren't fans of it. I'd never had it. We'd been only going out a few months at the time. So we go over there and prep this absolutely fantastic dinner in very, very difficult kitchen, environment. And, she wasn't very happy because evidently the bird that I cooked was way better than the one she cooked, including her husband saying, oh man, this is the best. This turkey is fantastic. Oh my God, the stuffing. Oh wow. Cause we did sort of the same thing for Christmas that we did for Thanksgiving with a couple of differences. And, I was so teed off because we had spent a good couple $100 on all of this stuff, and the vast majority of our Christmas day cooking for a bunch of people, because, you know, her mom wasn't really able to stand up and cook the dinner. And, you know, she said she was going to gruff it out, but no, could we do it? And then begged us to do everything at her house. So it was very difficult on us and absolutely unappreciative. Abso-friggin-lutely unappreciative. And, I was so teed off. I waited a couple days till after the whole Christmas thing was over and I said, never again. Never, never, ever again will I ever cook for your mom. I mean, she was so unappreciative. I felt like I was an inconvenience and she hated that our food was better than what she would have made. So, as it turns out, Thanksgiving comes around the following year, you know, 11 months later, and it was a different story. Now we're hosting Thanksgiving at my house. She wants to come over, and she was very gracious after that. I think maybe she'd had time to realize she didn't have to do anything, and it was good. So why should she risk her own personal health and be absolutely fatigued to make a meal that's not going to be as appreciative when she could just go out back, have a couple cigarettes, and let somebody else handle it? So it worked out well. Anyhow, guys, we're going to get back into the Second Amendment-related stuff, talking about some guns, some ammo, and some carrying as soon as we come back. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Bill Carnes, 1-800-313-9443.
All right, guys. Now, I want to preface this segment by saying I'm not a big fan of carrying weeny little calibered guns. However, I am a fan of, if you have a CCW, of you actually carrying. So if you're not going to carry your full-size 1911 or a good-sized Glock or next to you or something else, a good, solid, defensive pistol, if you're not going to carry it because it's too big or it prints when you carry it based on the clothing of that season of the year, whatever. Find something that you will carry and carry it. Okay? Train with it. Realize where it's holstered. Get that, be able to get that thing out. Train with it the way you're actually going to carry it. So I'm a fan of carrying a small gun if you're otherwise not going to carry at all. So, with that in mind, we're going to talk a little bit about smaller guns. Taurus is a manufacturer that comes out of Brazil. I believe all of their guns are manufactured out of Brazil now. I may be wrong. They were coming out with, I shouldn't say they were coming out with, they've had for some time the PT-92, the PT-99, then they came out with the PT-100, PT-101, things like that. And they look just like the Beretta. I mean, there's very little difference between a Taurus and a Beretta. There's many, many, many similarities. And a lot of people believe that that's because they were copying the Beretta. Not true. In fact, what happened was Beretta had a manufacturing plant in Brazil, and they wanted to move all of their tooling and everything back over to Italy. And I think they were even looking at putting something in the U.S. Anyhow, they were selling their plant in Brazil. Taurus bought it, and they had all the tooling and all the machining. They signed an agreement with Beretta. They would change, you know, a certain number of things, and they're going to continue to use the same tooling. So that's why the PT-92, the PT-99, 100, 101 look a lot like the Beretta, because they're using the same equipment that Beretta used to manufacture their M9 or 92F. Now they also have the 96 and all the variants. So that's where that came from. They weren't copying it. They were actually using the same tooling that they bought from Beretta in the same plant. With that being said, Taurus also happens to have the best warranty that you can get. And that is, we'll warranty the entire gun for the lifetime of the gun. Period. Doesn't matter if you bought it new or used. You're the 19th owner of the first. If it's a year old or if it's, you know, 48 years old. Doesn't matter. We'll warranty this thing for life of the gun. Forever. For as long as Taurus is in business, they will warranty their guns. You can't beat that. I actually had to send my PT-99 that I had years ago, 20 years ago, I had a PT-99. And I had something, the magazine release on it, something went goofy with that, so I sent it in. They got it, they fixed it up and sent it back. It was great. So, they have the new PT-738 TCP. And the TCP stands for Taurus Compact Pistol. But the PT-738, that is a 380. And they also have a 9mm, which is the 380-709 is the 9mm. All right? Just to give you a little bit of info on these guns. All right, the PT-738 is 10 ounces. Slightly over 10 ounces. And that is a polymer frame with a steel slide and a standard size magazine. You can get an extended magazine for it, which will hold a couple more rounds. It holds 6 rounds in the magazine, plus you can have one in the chamber. If you get the extended magazine, it's 8 plus 1. And this whole little thing, it's very smooth, it's very thin, it's a single stack magazine. If you get one, they have an option where you can get the slide where it's made of titanium as opposed to steel, and that drops it down to about 8 ounces in weight. Now, with the 9mm, you're talking about a gun that's a little bit bigger, still not incredibly big by any stretch of the imagination. It is 19 ounces, and you can get the slide on it, which is also made out of titanium, drop it down to 17 ounces. So only 2-ounce difference in the slides. That gives you an idea of how small it really is. They are very slim guns. They're less than an inch wide, and they come with very good fixed 3-dot sights. The trigger is much like the Glock with a little kind of a detent releasing trigger in the center. It's a double action only. It's about an 8 or 9 pound press, very smooth. So it operates much like a revolver. You don't have any external gadgets to have to deal with. There is a small safety on the side of it, I believe. If I can see this, no, there's not. It just goes direct. Load around, start pressing, just like a revolver. Same safety features as a revolver. Slightly heavier trigger, keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to shoot, stupid. And that's really the safety system that's on there. That's all you need. It's like a Glock or an XD or a Smith M&P, something like that. Now, You can find plenty of decent 9mm defense ammo, so get it. The cool thing is with these guns, with a polymer frame, which is very durable, and either a titanium or steel slide, you can shoot some hot loads through this thing. You can shoot some good quality ammo. Now, here are a few different quality 380 ammos that are on the market. One is the Korban DPX. Now, I'm a fan of heavier bullets, but there's also a combination with speed as well. The Korban has an 80 grain bullet that goes about 1,000 feet per second. The Federal has the Federal HydraShock jacketed hollow point, which is a 90 grain bullet, you know, 10 grains heavier, that goes about 900 feet per second. You've also got the Remington Golden Saber, yet another hollow point, these are all hollow points, which is 102 grains. So pretty heavy for a 380. Usually they're around 90 or 95 grains. That fires at 833 feet per second. So for comparison, it's about the speed of a 45 ACP and less than half the weight. Then you have the Winchester Silvertip hollow point, which is a lighter round. It's 85 grains going about a little over 900 feet per second. The real interesting one, though, however, is the Hornady Critical Defense. Now, I believe this to also be a hollow point. The Hornady Critical Defense, it's a 90 grain round, so it's about the average in the middle of the weights of these bullets, going at close to 950 feet per second. So the velocity is a little less than the Korban, but the weight is 10 grains more. That's about, you know, 12% more in weight. Excellent round. I'm a big fan of Hornady. Just the whole family history of Hornady, how they came about back in the day when it was Hornady Spear, how they came around and they got tooling for, they bought out a company that was making reloading equipment and dies and such. It's just an excellent family business and some really excellent stuff that comes out. So I was happy to see that the Hornady Critical Defense really seemed to set the stage. When it came to their shooting, where they actually did the patterning results, that Hornady Critical Defense also had the tightest pattern. Not that that's really a huge deal. I mean, we're talking 10 feet was where they measured the muzzle velocity, 10 feet front, which is standard. And I think they fired at like 25 yards. And 25 yards, the Hornady had under a 2.5-inch group with a little tiny 380. So that's pretty good. A lot of that has more so to do with the shooter than with the ammo, but still, there you go. You can use that for a little bit of comparison. So if you're going to go with the tiny-sized little pocket pistol, as they would call it, this is yet another good option on top of the Ruger LCP, the Kel-Tec that's out there, this Taurus. Taurus always has a reasonable price on their guns. Again, they have an excellent warranty on the deal. Life of the gun, anything goes wrong, we'll fix it for nothing. And you load that up with something like the Critical Defense by Hornady, and you've got a pretty reasonable defense gun. Now that you've got the gear and that you've got it outfitted with good ammo, what you need to do is train with it. Now, I own a few different handguns, as you can imagine. I own several different handguns. Every single one of them I train with. Now, I own, I don't know, 5 or 6 Glocks, something like that. And a lot of people say Glock is a Glock is a Glock. Not really true. For instance, I own a Model 20, which is a, not just full size, it's bigger than full size. It's their full size 10mm. And it's loaded with some hot rounds. That thing doesn't shoot quite the same as my Model 23, my midsize 40, or my Model 30, which is even smaller and in 45 ACP, which I keep loaded with 230 grain ball. So all of these different guns I train with. Now, they're all very similar. They all work and are manipulated very similar, but they feel different in the hand. And, of course, there's going to be a little bit different recoil with the different guns. Matter of fact, that Model 30, that smaller sized Model 30 that I carry the ball ammo in, the 45, doesn't really have that much recoil to it because it's got a double sprung recoil guide rod. So it keeps the felt recoil down. Grip and stance will pretty much do that. But just so you know how you're feeling it in the hand, in the wrist. The 10 millimeter does not have that. And that thing, when shooting the full power rounds, will kick like a miniature mule. But that is a rock and round. And with grip and stance, I can get good, quick follow-up shots. I've taken, you know, two-day courses where we're firing 400 or 500 rounds in a two-day course with that gun. And it's a great gun to shoot. If you're going to get one of these mini pocket pistols, just because you've shot a 1911 a whole bunch, then you go out and you get a Colt Mustang, which operates the same way, but it's in 3/8 ACP and it's much smaller. Don't think that somehow all of that training is going to just miraculously work in a gunfight with a gun that you don't shoot much. Whatever gun you carry is the gun you should train with most. I have seen many, many people make the mistake of coming out to take a multi-day course in defensive firearms training and bring something like a full-size 1911 for the training because they carry an officer's model or a Kimber Ultra Carry, which is a much smaller gun on the street. So they're training with a much bigger gun than the gun they actually carry. That's a mistake. Now, it's nice to be able to get the training. Certainly some stuff will cross over. But train what you carry. Run what you brung. All right? Bring the stuff that you carry. There was a couple that used to take courses for me on a regular basis. And they carried the car, K-A-H-R, the car, and 40 caliber. And I think he carried a 40. I think she carried a 9. Maybe they were both 40s. I forget. It's been a while. And they ran the 4-day handgun course with those guns. And they would oftentimes run them with fingerless gloves just because their hands would get torn up a little bit dealing with such a small gun. And the thing is they weren't looking to outclass the field or be the very best shooters on the line. What they were looking to do was make every single round count. They carried these guns on the range, the same that they carried them on the street, or, you know, and vice versa. However you'd carry it on the range, they'd carry it on the street, and they'd have them concealed. Small in the waistband holsters. They would carry extra magazines and in the waistband mag pouches. And that's how they would come out and train. Dedicated people to run what they brung and shoot the same gear in the same position the way that they would on the street. You can't get any better than that. You have to operate on the range the same way you would on the street. One thing that would absolutely drive me insane, is when somebody would practice something on the range that was not the right technique, absolutely not the right technique. And they would say, well, you know, I just want to take care of my gear here on the range. I wouldn't do that on the street. Well, I cry BS on that one. A perfect example. You run the gun dry where a semi-auto goes on slide lock. That's called an emergency reload. In some areas, it's called a speed load, where you look at the gun and you realize, all right, it's empty. The slide is locked back on an empty magazine. The right way to fix that is to reach back, find yourself a new magazine first. Once you index that magazine out and you're sure you've got it, as it's coming up towards the gun, you hit the magazine release so the old one ejects on the ground. These magazines pass in the air. And then you either hit the slide release or come back, pull the back of the slide, and let it go. Let it run forward on its own to get back into the gunfight. Two mistakes that happen. One is, people see that the gun is empty. They'll take the magazine out and throw it or drop it on the ground. Then reach back and go fishing for a new magazine. Okay. If you're an adversary on the other side of this person, and they take the magazine out and throw it and then go fishing around, what's that tell you? Well, it tells you that they're empty. And now they can take their time to size you up in their sights and get a few shots off. And you're done. You're at least shot, and you're not very effective in the gunfight when you've been shot in the chest a few times. So, don't telegraph that. You would keep the gun pointed towards the bad guy. They can't tell looking at the muzzle to slide his lock back unless you turn the gun. Don't do that. Keep it pointed at the bad guy. Find a new magazine first. Once you're sure you've got a new magazine with ammo on it, hit the magazine release, insert the new one, run the action, and get back into the gunfight. One of the things that people do on the range, which drives me nuts, is they'll look and see that this gun is on its slide lock. They'll take the empty magazine out, put it into a pocket or a pouch, then put a new magazine into the gun and run it. Like it's an administrative function. Guys, when do you shoot to slide lock? Well, on the street, it's when you're in a gunfight with somebody and you emptied your gun. That's why in a lot of circles it's called an emergency reload, because it represents an emergency. You're in an active gunfight and your gun's empty. You don't take the magazine out and put it in your pocket. What good is this empty magazine in an active gunfight? None. Zero. Nada. Nothing. It'll cost you your life, potentially, if you take the time to keep it, put it in a pocket, and then fish out a new magazine. Don't do that. Don't do it. Treat everything as though you're in a gunfight when you're on the range. That's the way you run your gun. That's what you'll learn at the 2A Radio Defensive Handgun Course coming up in March. Again, dates are forthcoming soon. So, that's the kind of thing you're going to learn there. I will give you a perfect example of doing this the wrong way, because whatever you do on the range, you're going to do on the street. I flat guarantee you. I'll tell you when we come back about the Newhall shooting that happened in Newhall, California, with CHP a few decades ago, when they were running revolvers. I'll tell you all about that when we return. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back. 1-800-313-9443. Uncle Sam taught him to shoot maybe a little too well. Finger on the trigger, loaded ball.
Okay, so I want to talk about the difference in training on the range as to how it's going to go on the street. However you train on the range is what you're going to do on the street. I'll give you an example of that. Back on, I think it was April 6th of 70, in Newhall, California, they call it the Newhall shooting, the Newhall incident, 4 California Highway Patrol officers who were shooting revolvers lost their lives. They were in a pretty brutal gun battle with some bad guys. Now, on the range that these guys trained at, it was a beautiful range, manicured grass, everything. And the guys who ran the range didn't want to run over empty shell casings or live rounds when they're mowing the grass. So they would tell the officers. They would say, you know, when you're done with those shell casings, empty them out into your hand, stuff them in your pocket, then reload your gun and get back into the shooting exercise. These 4 young Highway Patrol officers were found with empty shell casings stuffed in their pockets. Now, they were crouched behind cars, using the cars as cover, involved in an active firefight. And when their guns would go empty, instead of dumping these casings on the ground, then reloading their gun and getting back in, they're literally turning their backs, changing position, stretching their leg, trying to find a way to fight these empty shell casings into their pockets of their pants, like they'd been trained to do, before they would reload their guns and get back into the fight. Well, as the evidence would point, it got to a point where they were all fighting to get these casings into their pockets. Nobody was back in the gunfight with the bad guys. The bad guys were able to break from their cover, come around, and shoot and kill all of these officers. All found dead, with empty casings in their pockets. Now, I gotta ask you, is that the right way to train? The answer is no. The CHP trainers said, well, you know, when you're on the street, don't put them in your hand and then dump them in your pocket. Dump them on the street. But they had done this so many hundreds of times, that's what came natural. When you're in a gunfight, you shouldn't have to think about gun handling. You shouldn't have to think about marksmanship. All your conscious mind should have to think about are the tactics. And if part of the gun handling, which includes reloading the gun, includes the mindless act of putting stuff away in your pocket because you've done it so many times, it now becomes one of these things that is unconscious. You just do it. So, if that's the way you're training on the range, you're training incorrectly. Once I get the date set, you'll know about it. You'll have an opportunity to sign up. And this is the sort of thing, the type of thing that you're going to learn about, the 2A Radio Handgun Course, coming up in March. It'll be a 3A class. And this is the type of thing you're going to learn about, not just how to run your gun, but how to go home and practice. All right? You're going to leave much better than what you came. And on top of that, you're going to learn, you're going to leave with knowing what to practice when you get back home to keep the skills up and improve them. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule. Guys, I'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned for the Global Research Hour coming up next.
Bill will be here tomorrow. Will your freedoms? The 2A Radio Show, 7 a.m. Pacific, 9 Central, Monday through Friday.